Accession number 18199, Reel 3.
Brigadier MacDonald, who was the brigade commander, he came round, wished us all a Merry Christmas and so on. And anyway, rest of the day finished, or night finished, if you like. The next morning, Boxing Day, I got out the truck. And by that time now, it was thick snow. It had actually stopped snowing, and it never really snowed hard again. You'd have flurries, but it was only this one big downfall of snow, but it was frozen solid. And the sun was up, there'd always be a blue sky, lovely sunshine, but this wind was coming from the north all the time. And at that time we didn't really have adequate clothing. We had wind cheaters. Our battle dress had been taken away from us except for the slacks, and we had these wind cheaters, the thick woolly pulleys as they call them, and the spring vests, which weren't very popular, very uncomfortable. So we were rather inadequately clothed, really. It was quite cold. And night, when you were on a switchboard or a radio set at night, no matter which, it was so cold inside these vehicles. You just sat there all huddled up. And if a call came, you didn't want to move, you know, to answer the call. You'd curse really roundly, you know, eventually you would do it. And it used to seem that the only thing, you just felt you wanted to go to sleep all the time. But of course, if you did go to sleep, you'd miss a message. And this did used to happen, really. And unfortunately, quite a few of us dozed off and got caught. In my case, it wasn't too bad. I just got pay stopped. But some were quite serious, and there was a few fellows were sent to the FMA in Seoul, which is the prison, for sleeping on duty. But it was so cold, and it was basically only, you just did, because there was not very much traffic at night. And the radios, despite, it always amuses me when you see a film, you see John Wayne in the middle of a jungle, and he picks up a walkie-talkie, and he talks to a battleship, you know, 20 miles away, that promptly lobs a shell about 5 yards in front of him on a Japanese machine gun nest. And I think, well, I don't know what sort of radio he got, but we had the 19 set, which was the British standard radio set. And okay, the atmospherics in the day weren't too bad. It was quite clear and you could get a reasonable communication. But as the night came on, so the atmospherics got worse and worse. And the set was literally screaming at you. And the only way you could really transmit a message was by using the pressel switch, which is the speaking switch on the handset, as a Morse key, and it would sort of punctuate into the atmospherics. In the middle of the night, say 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, that's all you could do if you had to transmit a message. You couldn't speak. Then, as the daylight came, so the atmospherics improved, and by probably 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning you were talking quite clearly again. But it was quite difficult. And of course, also another thing was the telephone lines were always going out, either through the weight of snow, or trucks would go into the poles, or sometimes shell fire would cut them, sometimes they would just fall down, and there was never enough linesmen to go round, so you were often raked in as a sort of a linesman's mate, if you like, you know. And you went out with, whereas the linesman would normally go out in pairs, you would go out with one linesman helping him to repair the lines. This was quite common. And anyway, after a little while there, Sergeant Horton was posted out, and the sergeant came in, Sergeant Allerton, who'd been a corporal at 14th Field. 14th Field had been a very small troop, and everybody had been very friendly. Everybody was on first name terms. And whether he resented the fact that I knew him from before, but he did really seem to have it in for me a little bit. He seemed to single me out a lot, and I had a row with him one day. And the consequence of that row was a little while later. I said, I've had enough of this job, you know, and he said, you're bloody well stuck with it, whether you like it or not. I had to go to Div HQ as an escort to a driver to pick up some replacements, and one of them was a fella I knew from trade training. And I said, what have you been doing since we last saw you? He said, I've been a switchboard operator. So I said to Allerton when I got back, I said, yeah, this guy here, I said, he's been a switchboard operator. I said, how about letting him do my job and put me on the radio? So he said, well, he said, what I'm going to do with you, he said, I'm going to send you up to the rear link with the KSLI. He said, it's about time they were relieved anyway, they've been up there several months. He said, I'm sending you up there. And he sent up a chap with me, a driver Kitchener, who was, it wasn't a hard case, he was a non-conformist. You couldn't do anything with him. He just totally ignored everything anybody said to him. He used to say he was a communist, you know, and he used to wind the mess boys up. You know, when the Korean mess boys, he used to serve the dinners, you know, and he would go up to them and he would say, Syngman Rhee, you know, was the South Korean president. Sigmund Rhee, we go, number 10, number 10, he said, number 10, no good, number 10, Il Nam, it was the North Korean, and he put his thumb up, and he said, Il Nam, number one, he number one, number one, Il Nam come, you know, and those South Koreans, he had come berserk. And we didn't know, he just used to sort of say about having a revolution and, you know, arresting all the officers and that sort of thing, but it was all a big joke. I don't think he really was a communist at all, but he was just a non-conformist, but he was a very clever bloke in actual fact. He was quite clever. And he was sent up with me, and we went up to the KSLI, who at that time, we were back in the line, by the way, by now. And the rear link of the KSLI was myself, Kitchener. The corporal stayed behind. The two other guys were relieved. The corporal was a bloke called Harry Slater, Lance Corporal, a young regular. And funny enough, the three of us, we became really good pals, you know, we were all good mates. And we shared everything, and, yeah, good fellas. And, so it was in the line then, in the middle of 2-8 Brigade positions. On our right was the 355, which is a little Gibraltar, you probably heard people talk about 355. The Australians were on that. On our left was the KOSB. And they were slightly behind us. So our HQ company, Hill, we were looking across at one of their rifle companies, more or less directly in line with us. And this rifle company came under shell fire on quite a number of occasions. And on one particular occasion, and this would be early April 1952, they started shelling it quite early in the afternoon, and it was just, you could look across and all you could see was just the shells bursting on the hill. You couldn't see anything else. The hill was just disappearing in a cloud of smoke and dust. And of course we were put on full alert, and we had to check out the lines. We had a line running into the CO's bunker, remote control line, and we had to check our aerial, which went across the valley and so on, and we was on full stand too. And as the dark started, it started to get a bit dark, and shell fire increased, and then our own guns came. And then, of course, we were in the bunker. We couldn't go out the bunker. We could hear machine gun fire, small arms fire, flares going up. You know, you could hear the flares, see the flares going up if you peeked out. And in the middle of all this, the remote control line, we had a runner come from the CO's bunker, say the remote control line wasn't working, you couldn't get through to us. So Slater said, well, I'll stay in the set. He said, you and Kitchener, he said, one of you start from the bunker, and one of you start from here. He said, and trace the line and repair it. So, because we're going out, by this time the shells were coming right over our position. They were actually bursting in our MT lines, which were slightly behind us. And you could hear the machine gun fire, because there's Chinese flares, you know, these coloured flares going out through their signal flares. And it was quite eerie, really, and I was running the line through my hand, and I found the brake, And quite surprisingly, I thought, well, all I could do is, by the light of the flares or the shell flashes, repair it. And I thought, I'm going to make a mess of this. But I don't know whether it was, I was so concentrated and I repaired it so easily. I was quite surprised now how easily I repaired it. Quite amazed. I suppose it was the fact that you. I thought, actually, must concentrate your mind. Anyway, back in the bunker, and that was okay. We checked it out. And then the Chinese fire started to dwindle, and our own guns opened up. They kept up all night. And in the first light, an airstrike went in on the Chinese positions opposite us. And we found that, in actual fact, this company that we could see across from us had been attacked by Chinese assault troops. A couple of KSBs had been killed and two wounded, which was quite a surprising amount of shell fire that had been on the hill. And they found four dead Chinese inside the wire. But the Chinese always evacuated their wounded anyway, or dead, if possible. And our own machine guns had been firing on the forward slopes, because one of our companies obviously overlooked this company. And apparently the Chinese attacked using cut-off bushes as cover. I never called the Macbeth attack. That's how it came about. Now, of course, to me, I suppose it was the biggest action I was in, and I thought it was a really big thing, And you used to get the Daily Mirror in weekly form that the guys used to get from home, and it was sent in weekly form. So we all waited for this Daily Mirror to come out, so to see what the report of the battle would be, or the headlines, Just a couple of paragraphs, heavy shelling followed by a local Chinese attack. And I said, well, okay, perhaps that's all it was, but to me at the time it seemed like nothing on earth. Airstrikes were always a form of entertainment whenever the airstrikes went in on the Chinese opposite, because there was very little Chinese air activity, or none at all, virtually on the front. So you could go up on the top of our hill and watch the Sabre jets, normally, F-86 Sabre jets. They would come in, they would drop a couple of bombs, sometime in that plan, which would be very spectacular. Rockets, then they would machine gun some of the trenches. They were quite good for morale, really. Sometimes it was sea fire, sometimes they were meteors from the Australian Air Force. And of course, always afterwards, the little Oster planes would fly over, spotting, see what damage was done, or spotting for new targets. And they were so slow, you think they'd be shot out the air any time, but it never, so you see, they'd go up and down, never get hit. The only time an aircraft was hit in our area was an F-86, and it was hit, and the pilot, he was diving in, he was obviously hit, and he put the plane into a vertical climb to give himself some heights, and he bailed out. And the plane went on, crashed miles away in the north somewhere. And the pilot actually came down in Purple Heart Valley. And because our own OPs picked him up, and he was sort of sitting on a hill just smoking a cigarette. And he stayed where he was. He was obviously knew where he was. And obviously there were minefields, and he wouldn't have known his way through them. So he figured our patrols would come out and pick him out. So we sent a patrol out at first, at last light. And unfortunately, the Chinese had got to him first. And the rumour went round that this was General Van Fleet's son, who was General Van Fleet was the commander of the American 8th Army. And sure enough, Fleet's son was missing around that time, but he was shot down, he was killed actually in a Maraunder. Was it M26 Maraunder? B-26? B-26 in Maraunder, isn't it? Yeah, B-26. But that was on a power station up north, so this wasn't him. But because the rumour went round that Van Fleet's son was missing, everybody said, oh, that was Van Fleet's son, but obviously it wasn't. And soon after this Macbeth attack as well, any Australian positions with a tank from the 5th Dragoon Guards, and they used to use the tanks as an extra gun. And this tank was on the top of the hill, and the Chinese were taking pot shots at it. Was you could hear a free bump, bump, bump in the distance, and then the shells would come over, and they would explode somewhere near the tank or go over. One of them actually hit the tank, but didn't seem to do much damage. And again, we were watching. It was like watching a coconut shy, and complete safety to us. And Kitchener came running up the hill, and he said, "Ronnie," he said, "get back to the bunker. He said, Harry wants you." So when I went back to the bunker, Harry said to me, "Well," he said, "you know, you've been watching a coconut shy." He said, "But it got the rear link. That's our equipment with the Australians." So, "Oh no," he said. "Well, yeah," he said, "it's all gone quiet, and the Australians are rung through to us to tell us this, and they think one's dead and two are wounded." He said, "I can't raise him." He said, "I'm trying to get Captain Webb from brigade." He said, "You keep calling on the set." So eventually, about the same time, an Australian voice came up on the radio, and Captain Webb eventually answered the phone. He said he had heard about the incident from the Australians. He said, it's not that bad as they said, but one bloke is seriously injured and the other two are shaken up. And he said, "I'm going to send up a relief crew with a spare radio, because the radio's been smashed." And he said, "We'll come to you first." He said, "Tell Ron Larby," Sigmund Larby, "to go with them to show them what the ropes are in the rear link." He said, "Then we'll bring him back to you." So I said, "Okay." And the Jeep eventually turned up. Captain Webb, I think Sergeant Allerton was there, and these three guys. Wouldn't have been a Jeep, probably 15 underweight. And I piled in the back, and of course these three blokes had only just come out from England. And they were as nervous as anything. And they, well, they'd just got here, they'd been here about 2-3 weeks. Hardly settled in, and here they're going to be sent to replace a crew which had essentially been wiped out. And of course they were asking me 101 questions, you know, who obviously knew. Thought I was really experienced, which I suppose by this time, you know, I was getting that way. A silly little boy who turned up in Korea was disappearing very fast. And anyway, when we got to the Australian rear link, it wasn't so bad. The operator had been badly wounded and been evacuated. The corporal in charge and the driver had both been treated for shock and said no, they wanted to stay with the job. They didn't want to be relieved. So only one of these three fellas had to stay behind in the end. But what had happened was the operator had been on the set. The shell had burst by the bunker. A shard of steel had gone right through the sandbag wall and hit him in the back while he was sitting at the set. His name was Scott. I don't know what happened to him after that.
Which month is this?
This would be April 52, maybe May. Maybe May. Probably April. It was shortly after the Macbeth attack. Anyway, because I went back to the KSLI. And then shortly after that, the brigade was relieved by 2-9 Brigade. And the Shropshires were relieved by the Welsh Regiment. And again... As we got waiting to pull out, Allerton came up in a Jeep and he said, "Larby, I want you to come with me." He said, "You're coming back later." He said, "All you need is your rifle," he said, "and some pack, you know, washing kit or something." He said, "Just come with me." So we piled in the Jeep. We had our own truck, it was called a Jim Palace, which had a radio in as well. So I said, what's happening? Couldn't call him Reg anymore, like I could at 14 Field. I said, "What's happening, Sarge?" He said, "Well," he said, "you remember at 14 Field?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Remember when we used to go out on the scheme?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Do you remember we had a 10-line F&F, which was opposed to a 40-line?" Which I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you remember how to use one?" I said, "Well, of course I do." So he said, "Well," he said, "when the brigade moves out," he said, "we're taking down the 40-line F&F, and there'll be a 10-line put in temporary." And he said, "Believe it or not," he said, "you and I are the only two people in the troop who know how to operate one. None of the others knew, because I've used one in Hong Kong." So when we got to brigade, because the brigade was starting to pull out, we got this 10 line F&F out. It worked on a slightly different principle from the 40 line. The 40 line was rather like a switchboard you see anywhere, where you've got two lines, you know, one person calls, you plug in, they ask for somebody else, you take the other line and plug it in over here. The 10 line operated differently than that. You could only make sort of one call at a time, basically, on it. And you just plugged it straight into the number that you wanted. Anyway, we broke out the essential lines that we wanted and connected them up on the 10 line. And he said, well, one by one, these lines are ringing and you can disconnect them. And the brigade started to pull out. He left me a driver with a 15 underweight. And the driver was an older guy than me, he was a regular, I can't remember his name. But he was quite nervous and he kept saying, when we going? I said, well, you can't go yet. And he went off and looked around the bunkers and he found a load of C-7s, which were the American ration packs. So he said, well, this is all right. And he got a fire going, he sort of cooked us some tins of food, whatever we fancied. I don't think you know about the C-7s, do you know about them?
Tell me about them.
The C-7s was a small day pack that the Americans used to issue to their troops and also to us because we didn't have such things out there. There were three small tins of a main meal and three tins of biscuits, cookies as they called them, and a small tin of fruit. There would be 20 cigarettes, chewing gum, coffee, sugar, concentrated milk, and also a slab of chocolate, which you could either eat or make a cocoa drink with. And something the British Army had never thought of, a packet of toilet paper. And this was issued to an American for one day. There was also a smaller version called an assault pack, which would just be the one meal, the one tin of cookies, the chewing gum, and I think five cigarettes in an assault pack. So anyway, the driver, he said, this is all right. And he started looting all the cigarettes out of them. I didn't smoke, but I took some. I said, well, I'll take some for Harry and Kitch. They both did. Anyway, it was getting on and on in the day, and it was getting starting to get a bit dark. And this driver was getting really nervous. And he, oh, come on, let's get out. I said, can't go yet. Anyway, the last line, I said, okay, that's it. I said, that's it, let's go. Piled everything in. Grabbed a few more of these C-7s, because they were looked at as us as a bit of a snack, really. They weren't really substantial enough for Brits, I think, who used the more stodgy food, you know. And I sort of kind of thought, well, he was as nervous as anything. He was he'd probably been in the army about 7 or 8 years, you know. And I thought, well, I couldn't have handled that a few months ago. I'd have probably been as nervous as him. And I thought, well, I'm growing up here, you know. Anyway, I went back to the Shropshires.
What does F&F mean?
F&F, I've actually no idea. It was just a switchboard. It was called a 49 F&F. But what the F&F stands for, I couldn't really say. It
doesn't matter, but no. You were saying you went back to the Shropshires?
Yeah. Who were, of course, then in reserve. We were in a reserve location. And Harry Slater was relieved and was replaced by a bloke called Brooks. A nice enough fella, but Kitchener, he could not do a thing with Kitchener at all. He was just completely gone, you know.
Completely gone?
Well, he just done his own thing. The thing to get Kitchener to do anything was what Harry Slater realised was to let him do it his own way. You couldn't tell him how to do it. Because he wasn't going to do it. But say he would do it, and he would do it quite well, but you had to let him do it how he wanted to. And of course, Brooks, he made the mistake of telling him to do one or two things, and when he realised that he couldn't handle him, and I think Kitchener just held him in total contempt. I mean, I got on all right with Brooks, he wasn't a bad lad. Very conscientious. He was the only National Service NCO we had in the troop, I think. But why he wasn't an NCO, in preference to some other guys that I think were better than him, I just don't know. Anyway, after a while in reserve, I was then brought back to brigade, and I was relieved, and
to 2A brigade.
Back to 2A brigade. Yeah. We were still in reserve at that time, and the brigade major was being changed over. So the new brigade major came, and I was seconded as their operator during this changeover, while the old brigade major took the new brigade major out and about. And one incident we had there where we went to what they called the fallback line, which was called Line Kansas. This was south of the river, but the front line this time was north of the river, as you've gathered. But south of the river was this huge hill called Kamaksan, and Kansas Line was based on this. And he was showing him around the Kansas Line positions. And we drove off the main road up a sort of an entrance in the hills. And we were climbing up in this jeep, and all of a sudden, from out of nowhere, appeared about, probably about 20 or 30 Koreans. Heaven only knows what they were, because the hills back of the line were full of, deserters from both sides. Black marketeers, guerrillas, people who just would be out of the pinch. We just didn't know what they were. He said, I don't like the look of this lot, And they were running after the jeep, shouting and hollering, really scrappy looking lot. And I thought, I was at the back, and I had my rifle, and I just fired a shot in the air. It didn't stop them, so I fired another shot, and the brigade major drew his revolver. With that, they all stopped, and sort of stopped running after us. Anyway, we got to where we was going. It was like in a saucer-shaped depression. So that was to BM and said to me, "So, will you be all right, Signor?" So I thought, will I be all right? I don't know. that lot down the road, I don't know, So I was sort of said, "Well, I hope so, sir." So he said, "Well, we won't be far away." He said, "If there's any sign of our friends returning," he says, "just fire a shot in the air and we'll be back." So I was nervous as a kitten, and I recharged my magazine. I was calling brigade every minute, probably on the radio. But nothing happened, no more came, and we drove back down, but we drove back down warily, They both drew their revolvers, and I had my rifle out ready under the back, but we got back down to the main road. There was nothing else happened. But it was a bit worrying, because you didn't know who they were, really. It was quite a funny incident there as well. A little later on, the new brigade major, he kept on about the Australians, and he kept saying, "I've heard about these Australians. They're a bit unorthodox, a bit individual, aren't they?" So our brigade major never said anything. And every time we went out, he said, "Are we going to go to the Australians today? Are we going to the Australians?" And one day, the very last day of all, when the brigade major was going to leave, the day took him to the Australians. So he said, "Well, we're going to the Australians today." And as we drove up to the RAR, that's the Royal Australian Regiment positions, walking down the road with his back to us was an Aussie. It was quite a hot day. He had his bush hat on. He had his underpants and his boots and his belt still on.